Look at all this. Oh my gosh. Unbelievable number of. Okay.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2726 and invite our esteemed governor to join us. This is the House, not the Senate. You will notice we start on time here.
Mr. Chair, I am well aware that this is not in the Senate. Good afternoon. Huh? Mr. Chair and co-chairs Hayden and Noss, Rob Noss, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kate Brown, currently serving as your governor. And I'm here and just delighted to be here, frankly, to speak on behalf of House Bill 2726, which would provide Oregon health plan benefits to all children living in Oregon. Health care is foundational and fundamental to the well-being of Oregonians. We work towards being healthy ourselves so we can have fulfilling and engaging lives. We work to ensure health care to our children so they can learn, play, and grow into very healthy adults. It is our duty to ensure that our youngest Oregonians have the tools to grow into healthy adults with access to education, health care, and a bright future. I just want to share a story about a family from the coast who'd worked for years to become American citizens after arriving in Oregon. They struggled to maneuver the red tape accompanying the pathway to citizenship while caring for their epileptic teenage daughter. Because of their status, they were often forced to rely on expensive emergency room visits and stifling hospital bills for routine checkups and medication. Now, they are on the Oregon Health Plan after an arduous journey. The family is not only thankful, but very proud to call Oregon home. While we have made great strides together in increasing the number of Oregonians with health insurance, thousands of children remain uninsured. All Oregon children and families struggling to make ends meet should have access to quality care through the Oregon Health Plan. As Oregonians, we believe that all children should have the opportunity to be healthy and ready to learn. Oregon families should feel confident that a medical event will not dramatically change the trajectory of their lives. Let's take this step to ensure that all Oregon children have access to health care coverage. By building on past accomplishments and work already underway, we can make a significant impact for the youngest members of our communities. I think House Bill 2726, if I get the right number, provides us with an opportunity to invest into the next generation. We can provide basic elements for a better life by adding children into a system, 13,000 to 15,000 children into a system that we know works. Investing now will have a positive effect on our health system, our social services, our education, our economy, and Oregon's future. Thank you, and I encourage you to vote aye on the bill and send it down to Ways and Means as quickly as possible. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Is that fellow sitting next to you going to testify?
No, he's just here to take all the difficult questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't have a question. Can I just make a comment?
I think you're going to be next.
I do, but I would like to make a comment to our governor.
Do.
I just want to say how proud I am, Governor, that this is among your top priorities, that you care about every child living in this state, and that our state can't thrive unless all of our children thrive. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have a question. Was the funding for this in your balanced budget?
Yes, it was.
I was really proud to hear that. This is something I very strongly support, and we're going to do everything in our power to make sure it happens in this
Thank
session.
You. Send it down to Ways and Means as quickly as possible.
The following orders. We'll send it when we're told.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Jeremy, thank you for organizing things. Would you call the first panel, please?
Representative Huffman and Representative Elisa Kenny Geyer.
Step out.
Yeah, we just need to send a text.
Okay.
Representative Kindergarten, if you'll start out, we'll add Representative Hoffman when he appears.
We're going to try and give his office a quick call.
Please go for it.
Okay.
Oh, here he goes.
I asked
yes.
if the governor
came. Yes. You go first.
She specifically left because she heard you were coming.
I chased her off. Chair Greenlake, committee, thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 2726, Cover All Kids. I'm John Huffman, state representative for House District 59. So I'm good to go?
Yes, please.
You're just on the edge of your seat. I just wondered if it was to listen or throw me out. I wasn't sure. I never know with you, sir. Though others in the room today are likely to argue other points of merit from their perspective for House Bill 2726, for me, the bill just makes sense. It makes sense morally and it makes sense economically. Morally, because I have always advocated for supporting our most vulnerable citizens. Arguably, Oregon's kids should be at the front of that line for protection. As we have budget discussions this session about how many people we can afford to cover under Oregon's Medicaid program, I want to make sure that our kids are prioritized on that list. And economically, because I believe healthy kids miss fewer days of school and their parents miss fewer days of work, making everybody more productive. Some might say that this bill is not needed because kids in Oregon already have access to health care. This is part of my purpose for this bill. It is something that the work group working with the Oregon Health Authority can verify. Wouldn't it be great if we found out that our suspicions were incorrect and, in fact, all Oregon kids have access to health care, quality health care? But I suspect that's not the case. Many in healthcare delivery that I work with on a daily basis in my job, like Providence, Oregon Health Sciences University, and Pacific Source, also support making sure that our kids get ready access to preventive care and quality medical care. Simply having access to an emergency department is not quality care. Ultimately, I truly believe that covering kids up front saves us money down the road. Thank you, Chair Greenlake and committee, for your support. Hope you support. I urge you to support House Bill 2726. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. You want to comment, and then we'll get questions.
You want me to go ahead and then questions for both of us? Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, and fellow members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from House District 46, Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm really honored to be here following the governor and with my good colleague, Representative Huffman. And I have a picture here and a letter that I would like to read. It's also in OLIS, but it's my great honor to read it from Representative Vic Gilliam, who was the chief sponsor of this bill last time around. This is a picture of Representative Gilliam and myself at the end of the 2012 session that was posted by the Oregonian, and it says Vic Gilliam, Republican Silverton, embraces Rep. Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, Democrat Portland, during the close of the 2012 session. I remember something else in the article about a show of bipartisan support, and so I'm very honored that the more this bill has surfaced and the more this concept has surfaced in the last couple of years, the more people have really joined on. And I think if you look at OLIS and you look at the great number of letters that has come in from the president of OHSU, from Providence, from so many of the medical in the medical community who have now joined with many of the other voices that were at the table saying this makes moral sense, economic sense, it just makes sense all the way around. So the letter that I have from Vic says, and he just sent this a few days ago, long before the 2017 session began, I was a proud supporter of the concept of Cover All Kids. Now, as a former representative, or as Chair Barker calls me, a has-been, I am still proud of the team bringing this important issue forward. SB 558 and House Bill 2726 bills are worthy of your thoughtful consideration. I wholeheartedly support our state providing medical assistance within available funds to low-income children residing in Oregon. These bills offer care and compassion to a vulnerable Oregon population, and it offers savings and illness prevention for all Oregonians. Our communities are stronger when all of our children are healthy. This is not just another government entitled program. Offering strategic assistance for vulnerable children and families enables them for success at a critical point and in a vital area of their lives. This policy is not only beneficial to them, but for the well-being of their neighbors and all Oregonians. I offer this quote from a major force of compassion in Oregon, my friend Alberto Moreno, whose birthday it happens to be today. When he said this about the children this movement and policy seek to assist, quote, children who were brought here by their parents, 20,000 children fleeing wars, genocide, and economic displacement, and these children, our children, Oregon's children, go each day without life-saving medical care. No, these children are not the problem. These children are instead of a barometer of our compassion. I close with this. This is still Vic Gilliams. I close with this scripture when Jesus said in Matthew 25:45, I tell you the truth. When you refuse to help the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were refusing to help me. I will leave the important details to you, my able and former colleagues, and I thank you both for your service and this opportunity to share my support for Cover All Kids. Vic Gilliam. I am passionate about this bill. I know there are many other people that would like to talk about it, many people who wanted to, and I know you wanted to keep it to 20 minutes, so I won't take any more time other than, again, to tell people, please go to OLIS because there's so many people who wanted to talk here, and we couldn't fit them in. So thank you for the opportunity to allow me to speak.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will you please call the next panel?
Laura Etherton and Dr. Risa Bradeen.
Maybe two at a time.
Oh, and we can bring up John Baker.
Over. I think it.
Okay.
Good call. I'm going to let the lady speak first.
Wise man.
Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Sun, members of the committee, my name is Laura Etherton. I'm a state and federal policy director with the Oregon Primary Care Association, and respectfully ask you to support House Bill 2726. The Oregon Primary Care Association, OPCA, is a nonprofit organization with the mission to support Oregon's 33 federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers. Community health centers in Oregon deliver integrated primary care to over 400,000 Oregonians, and nearly one-third of these are children. Community health centers are providers within CCO networks, and one in four members of the Oregon Health Plan receive their primary care at a community health center. Community health centers provide primary care to thousands of the children who would benefit from this bill, and community health centers will continue to do so if this bill is passed. Providing coverage and providing care for children and adults, regardless of insurance status, regardless of ability to pay, is a core part of the mission of community health centers across Oregon. Health centers provide essential primary care services, but we are only one part of the broader healthcare system, and children need access to the whole system. We know that without coverage, many patients unfortunately delay accessing primary care and have a very big problem accessing care beyond primary care and enter into those situations fearful of high out-of-pocket costs. And for these reasons and more, we believe children should have full coverage. Coverage would allow these children to access primary care across the state in communities that don't have a community health center, and to have the full choice of providers, because not every provider works at a community health center. By covering all children, health centers will be able to reach out and provide services to even more of the remaining uninsured and underinsured across our state. Every child deserves a healthy start in life. We've seen in Oregon the benefits that have come to children when the Oregon Healthy Kids program was expanded. When children moved from being uninsured to having coverage, we're able to deliver better care and get them the coordinated care that Oregon has made such progress achieving. Thank you so much for your time today, and I urge your support for House Bill 2726. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Risa Bradeen. I'm Regional Medical Director for Children's Services at Providence Health and Services, and thank you very much for the opportunity to support this important legislation. As an organization driven by our mission to serve the poor and vulnerable, Providence Health and Services fundamentally believes that access to health care is a basic right, especially for children. As such, we support efforts to expand Medicaid coverage to all children in Oregon whose families fall below the 300% federal poverty level, regardless of how a child came to reside. Beyond coverage for these children's lifelong health and wellness, coverage is incredibly important to the economic stability of families today and to the long-term economic success of our state, Oregon. For families struggling to maintain steady employment and housing, healthy children can make a huge difference. With fewer missed school days, parents are able to be at work more often and have fewer unexpected medical bills. Timely access to wellness checks and vaccinations means manageable health issues do not become complex and are easier and less expensive to manage. For the children, health insurance coverage is fundamental to future success and opportunity. Studies show that health insurance decreases high school dropout rates and increases college completion. Another important point, particularly when we consider that most of these kids already face significant hurdles based on their economic status, their race, and adverse childhood experiences. By rolling children into CCOs at an early age, this legislation clearly aligns with our transformation efforts to reduce high-cost utilization and set these children on a healthy path before faced with chronic conditions as an adult. Additionally, coverage for wellness and preventive services will ensure children are ready for kindergarten, reduce the achievement gap, and increase our graduation rates. Providence has been a longtime supporter of Medicaid expansion as part of healthcare reform and believes expanding coverage to all Oregon children under the 300% FPL is a reasonable extension of those efforts. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment, and we hope this committee and the legislature will join Providence in support of Oregon's children.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee, for being here. Mitch Greenlick, Chair, Cedric Hayden, and Rob Nossi, and the new members, Jody Hack, Shara Mulstrom, and Teresa Alonzo Leon. Thank you for your service. I will share a personal story. Both my sister's kids are on the Oregon Health Plan, and she's a single mom, and without it, she would not be able to keep her kids.
Please?
Oh, John G. Booker Jr. Sorry, Mitch. She would not be able to keep her household and whatnot going because this is true for we're a mixed family. We're part Puerto Rican in our family and part English people. And those, I'm glad to see that they're addressing those communities because they're very underserved. We know for a fact that the people of color population in the city of Portland, they fall through the cracks a lot of times, people of color and minorities. And it's great to see that we're expanding this program to help those people in need. That's why I'm sharing that story, because without the health care, they would not be staying in school and keeping going what they're doing. In answer to your question, I know that there's going to be revenue issues coming up. I just want to make a suggestion and put it into your minds that there is I would suggest a new tax within the healthcare industry to help fund these programs, like the great programs. And I know the healthcare industry is supporting to pay more taxes. So I really would appreciate, you know, any revenue source we can get to keep these programs going, Senator Greenlick and the committee. And it's just a wonderful program. I've seen a lot of wonderful things happening. I'm also a Lions Club member, and I also support the sight and hearing program because we know that kids who have all the faculties in school do better successfully. They stay out of our prison population pipeline, and they do a lot. It really helps to do, because if we invest now, we will save in the long term, and we will not have to come back and do this budget thing again. So I thank you for your service, all of you, and thank you for your listening to me and the time. Thank you.
Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much. We will be working on this bill probably next week. I need to remind people we're talking about less than a third of a percent increase in the Medicaid population, a very small group. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2726 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2580. Madam Administrator, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2580 comes to you at the request of Representative Rayfield. It exempts foster children and homeless youth from the requirement to enroll in a CCO or coordinated care organization in order to receive medical assistance.
Representative Rayfield, welcome.
And Ashlyn, if you want to, those are the two. Thank you.
What's that funny tie?
Chair Greenleck, that's called fashion. With all due respect, Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, I am here to talk about House Bill 2580 and not the lack of Chair Greenleck's willingness to wear a tie. My name is Dan Rayfield, State Representative from House District 16. The bill that you have before you, I thought I'd give you a little background. The language in the bill is only temporary. We're currently working on language to kind of solve a larger problem, which is continuity of care within foster children and homeless. As you may know, child welfare, all children in child welfare qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, but they are not auto-enrolled into a CCO. Most children are eventually enrolled into a CCO for fully integrated coverage. However, most of the children are removed from full CCO enrollment, where they only have dental and mental health coverage within a CCO, and on the physical side, they're actually fee-for-service, which eventually transfers over. The problem with the fee-for-service is there is some continuity of care issues that arise, and we have had issues in my district with foster children and homeless children who do not get that continuity of care, specifically if you have children moving, say, from Linn County all the way to, say, Jackson County. There's delays in getting the important treatment that they need as this goes on. The policy is already in place to really take care of this. It's more of an implementation issue. And so we have been working with HealthShare of Oregon on solutions to kind of this continuity of care. And Ashlyn Stronken from HealthShare of Oregon kind of talk a little bit about the amendment that will be coming forward. Jonathan Eames, who does not like to show up to the Human Services sub bright and early in the morning, has labeled this the Willy Wonka golden ticket solution, but we'll let Ms. Strong talk about that more in detail.
Thank you. Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ashlyn Strong, and I serve as the Director of Public Policy and Communications for HealthShare of Oregon. HealthShare is the state's largest CCO, serving more than 200,000 Oregon Health Plan members in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. Our CCO is a 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization that was founded and continues to be governed by 11 healthcare and social service organizations serving OHP members. 2.5 years ago, HealthShare initiated a strategic objective specifically around improving the healthcare system for children in foster care. This is what we've done so far. We created a full-time foster care systems manager position at HealthShare to manage strategic efforts. He's here in the room in case you have any complicated questions that I can't answer. We facilitated a year-long learning collaborative with 7 local clinics and clinic systems to explore and implement foster care medical home models for children in foster care. We launched a care coordination platform to allow electronic coordination between physical health, behavioral health, dental health plans, and the child welfare system for our children in foster care. We grant-funded a medical liaison position within our local child welfare office. We provided trainings on the special health care needs of children in foster care to local agencies and provider groups. And we partnered with local child abuse medical assessment centers to develop specialized medical exams for children entering care. So although we've been able to make quite a bit of headway in our own CCO and on our objective to improve the statewide system of care for children in foster care, there's a lot more that can be done statewide that Representative Rayfield mentioned. So some of our concerns statewide are around enrolling children in foster care into CCOs, into fully integrated CCOs, as soon as possible so that they can get the care and the screenings that they need. Difficulty in accessing care when transitioning either between CCOs or between fee-for-service and CCOs. And ensuring that all children in foster care have the ability to access care that is designed specifically to meet their special health care needs. So to that end, we've been working with Representative Rayfield and Representative Fahey on developing a comprehensive plan that would include auto enrollment into CCOs, more robust data sharing across agencies, a web-based universal electronic health record, a healthcare passport, or a golden ticket for mobile populations like children in foster care. So we don't have that language back yet, but we look forward to coming back and talking to you about it more once we have the language.
When we get the language, we'll have questions for you, and we'll call you back. Well, we have questions already, all
yes,
right?
Yes, we do.
And who are those questions?
Rep. Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And I like your attire.
My big mouth, it gets me in trouble.
So I have a question on lines 25 and 26 here of the current bill, and I do understand that you have some amendments coming forward, but in 2014, foster care children under the ACA were given the benefit of being covered until age 26. On your provision H, line 26, you're talking about persons under the age of 21 who are homeless. Would this bill inadvertently or purposefully, I'm not sure, remove coverage under the ACA for homeless previously foster care children?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, that actually, all that language is going to be washed out. This was initially a conversation that was going on with the Oregon Health Authority for about a six-month period of time, trying to find a various solution. Throughout that six-month period of time, we weren't able to get to where we are now with HealthShare of Oregon. And so that language was more merely a conversation starter and was kind of the ending point of the conversations with the Oregon Health Authority. And so all of that language will be taken out. So you won't have that in the amendment that will be coming forward once we get that back from Legislative Council.
So follow up.
All right.
So in other words, if they were covered under the ACA, they would continue to be covered.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to seeing the new language. It's in process, I take it?
It is, and we'll let you know as soon as we get a copy of it back.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2580. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2644. Madam Administrator, what have we got here, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2644 is before the committee at the request of Representative Malmstrom. This is providing that the administration of vitamin K to newborn infants must be by injection. And would you like me to call the first panel?
Yes. Will Representative Malmstrom introduce the bill?
Yes, she will be
okay.
Part of the panel.
Go ahead.
Dr. Hoffman and Kate Wilcox.
Can you see if you can calm them down?
I will. I'll go right there.
Chair Greenlick and other members of the committee, I'm Sherry Malmstrom, state representative, and I am here today to start the discussion on House Bill 2644. The reason why I have become a sponsor of this bill is I've been approached by people in the pediatric medical community and public health community from which I've had a long 30-plus years of serving in. And this comes about simple preventive
preventative measure for a catastrophic problem. Before I was in public health, I was a labor delivery nurse, and I gave many, many of these injections. And in my career in public health nursing, I've followed up on lots of children with health problems. I've never experienced in my career any particular problems with this administration of vitamin K injections. First of all, I want to say on this bill, this is not to say that this is something mandatory. Like anything else, if a parent does not want their child to have a vitamin K injection, they don't get one. And it doesn't mean that a person cannot get oral drops. It simply is allowing for physicians to give the most effective way of administering this and not have to offer necessarily, you know, a less effective method. I have here in support of this bill a letter that you should have from OLIS, and I'm going to read a little bit of it. This is from Kaiser Permanente's chief of pediatrics. Vitamin K is a vital medication for newborns and is a required cofactor in the blood clotting process of humans. Vitamin K administered by injection shortly after birth helps prevent catastrophic bleeding in newborns. Without it, blood does not clot appropriately, and significant bruising and bleeding can occur with the most innocent of mild traumas to the body. Serious bleeding in newborns often happens in the brain and intestines, leading to serious morbidity and mortality. And the most effective way to deliver vitamin K to a newborn is by injection immediately after birth. Children and adults obtain adequate vitamin K levels from the bacteria that live in their intestines and from varied diets. Before birth, babies receive very little vitamin K across the placenta. Because newborns, especially those born by cesarean section, are born with sterile GI tracts and their diets are not rich in vitamin K, they are at great risk for bleeding without an initial injected dose of vitamin K. As an oral vitamin K preparation is not commercially available in the United States, but has been used in some babies, but it is not as effective as injected vitamin K. Oral dosing also requires repeated doses, which are likely to be forgotten, not to mention, I will add, we've all had exposure with babies and they spit up and who knows how much they're really going to get. This method of vitamin K is much less effective and puts newborns at unnecessary risk for a devastating vitamin K deficient bleeding. So I'll turn this over to Dr. Hoffman.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm sure you can hear me adequately. Chairman Greenlich and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Benjamin Hoffman. I'm a professor of pediatrics at Oregon Health and Science University. I've been a primary care pediatrician for 22 years, and I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon Pediatric Society. So we're here today to ask you to support House Bill 2644, which, as Representative Malmstrom said, will help prevent potentially deadly bleeding in infants through administration of vitamin K at birth via an injection, which is the only scientifically proven safe and effective way to ensure that babies don't suffer catastrophic hemorrhages. This bill has support in addition to Kaiser Permanente from the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Midwifery Council, the Oregon Chapter of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. Currently, the law states that the physician or midwife who's attending the birth of a child is responsible for ensuring that the infant receive vitamin K within 24 hours of birth by the most appropriate means, either injection or orally. As written, there's an implication that oral vitamin K is equivalent to injected vitamin K, but in fact, that is not true. Only injected vitamin K prevents the risk of severe bleeding for infants. And I want to be very clear here to reiterate what Representative Malmstrom said, that the intent is not to undermine or diminish a caregiver's right to make an informed decision for their child, and specifically does not alter a family's right to decline vitamin K or to elect an oral dosing regimen. It is crucial to note, however, that in this effort to protect newborns in Oregon from catastrophic bleeding, I'm equally passionate about families making truly informed decisions through shared decision-making practices based on the best available evidence. As a practicing pediatrician, I frequently work with families who have questions and doubts about things like vitamin K. My experience is that through a thoughtful and respectful conversation, with parents and caregivers, many of those fears can be allayed, and we can reach a mutually acceptable approach to ensure that the best interest of the baby is achieved. As Representative Malmstrom read, babies are all born deficient in vitamin K for a variety of reasons, including the fact that it does not cross the placenta, so a mother's vitamin K is not shared. Human breast milk has negligible amounts of vitamin K, and she talked about the presence of the bacteria in the gut. We get vitamin K through our diet, primarily leafy green vegetables, and through the bacteria in our intestines that enable us to have adequate levels to clot. Newborns, approximately 1 in 100 of them, will suffer a significant bleeding event if they're not given vitamin K at birth. This risk of serious, potentially deadly bleeding extends all the way through 6 months of age. And in Oregon, that translates to about 400 babies per year. Every major scientific medical organization, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the World Health Organization, and the National Institutes of Health, recommend administration of 0.5 to 1 milligram of injected vitamin K as an intramuscular dose. Only dosing by injection truly prevents vitamin K deficiency bleeding. The use of oral dosing may help prevent some of the less severe bleeding, but it doesn't prevent the catastrophic hemorrhage that can be so devastating. It's late onset bleeding that involves severe hemorrhage into the abdomen, the lungs, and in about 60% of cases into the brain. In those events, there's approximately 25% mortality rate. 25% of the babies who suffer that bleeding will die. Only the injection can completely mitigate that risk. I can look you in the eye and tell you I have cared for infants who have died from vitamin K deficiency bleeding, and it's not something that will ever leave me. Despite every effort, every medication, every attempt to help, I've watched an otherwise perfect baby bleed to death. I've cried with despondent parents, and I remember their tearful pleas, "If we only knew." And I'm here because I want nothing more than to prevent any more needless suffering and pain. The law as currently written implies a false equivalence between oral and injected vitamin K. And as I hope I've conveyed, this is just not the case. Oregon is one of only 5 states that allows administration of oral vitamin K at birth through either rule or statute. Should a family choose to decline evidence-based recommendations for preventing vitamin K deficiency bleeding, I fully support their right to do so. I also agree that administration of vitamin K by mouth is better than no administration at all. And should a provider feel comfortable in that practice, I would not deny them that ability.
Can you wrap it up, please?
Yes, sir. What we're asking for is a common sense approach to aligning Oregon law with what we know to be best practice. We're asking you to put kids first to protect babies from a completely preventable threat to their health using a proven, safe, and effective dose of a vitamin. I want to reiterate that this bill will not interfere with a parent's right to make informed decisions for their baby, and in fact should help ensure that caregivers are making the best possible choice for their infants. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Kate Wilcox from the Maternal and Child Health Section of the Oregon Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority. I second the science that they all have shared with you already, so I won't reiterate that. But I did want to share a little bit more of the science that we know. Since 1961, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that newborns receive vitamin K to prevent from this deadly condition. However, in 2003, their recommendations changed, and are we recommending that it be an injection, single injected dose, rather than the multiple oral doses. The oral doses aren't conclusively similar around the amount and how often, as the doctor has suggested. One other part that I wanted to share was the science that has gone behind the injection. There are some concerns that the injections lead to increased childhood cancers and particularly leukemia. Multiple studies have found that actually the vitamin K injection is safe and effective. In Tennessee, the Department of Health and the CDC have done an investigation in cluster vitamin D deficiency bleeding, where the cases of the parents had declined the intramuscular administration and opted for the oral. The reasons cited were multiple, but what was found was that there was no increased risk for leukemia or childhood cancers as a result of receiving the vitamin K through an injection. So House Bill 2644 supports the current standard of care by encouraging the administration of vitamin K through injections. And thank you, and I'm happy to answer some questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions?
Bueller.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Why do we need to enshrine medical best practices in law? Oregon, when the vast majority of states don't do this.
So, Representative Buehler, I don't think I'm in a position to be able to answer the question of why. I think the fact remains that it exists in law. And I can tell you I will be working in our newborn nursery in a week. And I've got to know what to do with families to be able to help them protect their infants. The fact that it exists in law now is because it exists in law now. Other states have done it in different ways, through rule or through code. We find ourselves in the situation where the law exists, and we need to be able to identify what the best practice is to protect babies.
Okay.
Quick. That's it. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. You mentioned that if parents had objection, and I don't know why they would, to a needle versus a religious objection, you mentioned that the oral would still be available. I don't see that in the bill.
So, Representative Hayden, my understanding is we had submitted a request for an amendment to specifically state that it does not preclude the opportunity to receive oral dosing. One of the challenges that we face in hospitals is that because there is not an FDA-approved oral form for infants, we're forced to use the injectable form and give it by mouth, and that also makes very complicated the subsequent dosing, which needs to happen over the next 2 weeks, as the only form that we can give to a patient to bring home is a 5-milligram tablet. And with the dosing, that makes it very complicated. There are forms of vitamin K that are available online and in pharmacies, but they are considered supplements and are not regulated, and so it makes it very difficult to vouch for their safety or their efficacy.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. And if we get a nasal spray, which can be equivalent in some cases with some medications to injections, if we get a nasal spray for this that could be proven to be equivalent, would we then have to come back and change the statute to get that accepted as best practices, or do you think hospitals would just adopt that?
Can you address that?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's like anything else. When we find in the medical world that there's something new and better, then we look at what's the best way to implement that practice.
So let's just carry the. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So let's carry this through. So let's say 6 months after we pass this law, a nasal form of vitamin K comes out. We're going to now have thousands of infants in Oregon have an injection and the pain associated with that, and possible risk, depending on your perspective, until we can come back to the next legislative session and get approval to use an intranasal dose. To me, that does not seem to be a very good use of legislators' time, nor a good use of your time, nor a very good practice for infants in Oregon.
I'll be happy to sponsor that bill.
Representative Buehler, I think your point is very well taken. What this bill would require is, if a family chooses not to get the intramuscular injection, they have to sign. They decline that. If there were another form, they would still be allowed to do that. They might have to sign the document declining the injectable form until such time as the legislature could come back and change that. Again, the issue of whether this exists in statute or in rule is. That's above my pay grade. Our interest is just making sure that babies are safe.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I'm with you. I love that you're here to make babies safe. That is a good point, though. On the nasal spray, would there be then a consultation required by the physicians to sit down with the parents and say, here are your choices, nasal, injection, or oral, and is that going to be in the bill? I mean,
Representative Heck, that's already done. When we administer anything to newborns, there's a consent process that parents go through. If they have questions or concerns, then those are not able to be addressed by the caregiver who's working with them. If it's a delivery room nurse or somebody along those lines, there will be somebody else, a pediatrician, family doc, a licensed healthcare provider, who's responsible for having those conversations to ensure that families do have the best available evidence to make the right decision for their baby.
I have a follow up.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
We have two panels of folks who want to testify against it, so we need some time.
Do we know if there's a nasal?
No.
Being okay.
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, there is not. And as I said, there are only two FDA approved forms. One is the injectable / intravenous form, and one is a tablet.
Thank you.
That's something Representative Hayden just made up on the fly. Representative, you have the last question. Well,
yes, thank you, Chair. So what would be the enforcement mechanism and the penalty if a physician didn't abide by this statute?
It's a good question. I would assume that my medical license would be in jeopardy.
So if this statute didn't exist, what would be the penalty and enforcement if not undertaken by a physician? I don't see anything about medical license in here, so I don't think that's necessarily the case. So,
yeah, I honestly, I do not know. That's a good question.
I don't think there's any difference.
Thank you. I'm happy to look into it and find out.
Right, it's complaint driven like anything else.
Right. Exactly.
You have a brief question?
Well, I do, and I do want to point just to the very last part. It says that the only consequence I see is that the authority shall notify their licensing board's medical or midwifery board of it. I don't see any heavy-handed. My question, really, because I believe that the next panel will be bringing up concerns, and I know that you've weighed, but in the testimony they were kind of far apart. The possible consequence, and I'm asking in part because Representative Buehler mentioned the potential downside of an injection. So I just want to hear you kind of side by side say, what is the possible downside of an injection? And, you know, is there a question about can you reduce the pain on it? And what is the downside of the oral, the way that it is given orally through the tablet on your own or taking the dosage that's not FDA approved? Like, could you just, for clarification before we hear the next panel, side by side?
Briefly, I will do my best.
And also reiterate one more time, this would not take away any rights of any parent to make decisions on behalf of their children.
Correct. That is absolutely true. So the risk of any injection is infection anytime skin is disrupted in any way. I assure you that these injections are done in accordance with best practice, with sterile technique, et cetera. There are some risks that are identified in the package insert to the intramuscular vitamin K, which I'd be happy to address. But it turns out that the biggest concern, which is one around allergic reactions, has only ever been reported once. There are 4 million deliveries in the United States annually. Almost every baby gets injected vitamin K. There's only been one single episode. As far as the issue of pain, I completely sympathize with parents. I have 3 children. I had to watch my children endure that, as well as all their immunizations. They're all alive and healthy and wonderful. We know that that there are many things that we can do to help soothe an infant, including having them being held by their parent, especially having them breastfed, can be incredibly powerful. For those children who can't, we'll offer them what's called a Sweeties, which is a sugar water containing pacifier that's been shown to be very effective in interventions like circumcisions in decreasing infant pain.
And the downside of oral, I wanted to
the hear. The downside of oral is that it does not prevent the catastrophic bleeding. Approximately 3 per 100,000 babies who get the oral dosing will still suffer the catastrophic bleeding, which is basically brain hemorrhage, lung hemorrhage, or abdominal hemorrhage. And those are the once that starts, it's almost impossible to stop.
Thank you for bringing this to us.
Thank you.
Can you call the next panel, please? We have 2 panels. I'm going to ask you to be relatively brief, and I'm going to ask you to recognize that the bill does not change the parent's right to make a decision.
Brittany Ruiz, Stacy Black, Paula Bryant.
And then there'll be 3 more Denise? After that.
Therese, that's okay. Nobody can pronounce that.
any order. Just
okay.
Introduce
I'll
yourself.
Probably start first since I have three kids outside.
Good.
Wise.
Thank you for bringing them.
Thank you for having me, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Brittany Ruiz. I'm a member of an organization called Oregonians for Medical Freedom, and I'm also a parental rights activist. I moved to Oregon because you guys have wonderful, you guys uphold the Constitution, and you make sure that there's no breach in terms of mandates and requiring of medical mandates here in the state of Oregon, and that's why our family moved here, because we did not want to have more people telling us we had to do this or we had to give that. And I'd rather just have the freedom to be a mom. That being said, in February 1st, 2011, I had to be induced. I had an amniocentesis because I had to be induced early. If there's any doctors on here, you'll know the condition. It's called cholestasis of pregnancy. I had to be induced early. So they checked my daughter's lungs to make sure that they were fully developed before I was induced. I was induced at 36 weeks, February 7th. My daughter was 4 weeks early. She came out wonderful. Right after she was handed to me, she got weighed. She was handed to me briefly and then went and got her vitamin K shot like that. Came back to me, and within 2 minutes, I was told, hey, there's something wrong with your daughter's breathing. And they rushed her to the NICU. And they did every manner of test. They did every blood test. They did x-rays. They did everything to see if there's something wrong. Were her lungs not developed? We checked everything. And they literally, my daughter still has scars on her feet from the amount of blood pricks that they did to figure out what was going on. Everything, every test came back negative. Everything came back negative. Her lungs checked great, but she couldn't breathe on her own. She had to be on a CPAP for 4 of the 7 days that were there, and then went on to air right after that. Now, it wasn't until recently that a friend of mine shared the insert of the vitamin K shot. I had no idea, first of all. By the way, my doctor never told me that there was any risk. My pediatricians never told me there was a risk. My doctors never ever told me a risk that there was actually a risk to the vitamin K shot. Never were they ever told me that there was even a black box warning on the vitamin K shot. And specifically, premature babies were at risk to the side effects. My daughter was a premature baby. My doctor never said, hold off on that vitamin K shot. She has a risk of anaphylactic or respiratory arrest. Nobody ever said that. So I'm going to read the definition of a black box warning. You probably all know it, so I'm going to just do one line. The agency can require a pharmaceutical company to include a bold warning on the packaging and the patient instruction sheet if serious or life-threatening risks are associated with the drug. Black box warnings take their name from the black border around the information and are the FDA's most stringent warning a drug can carry before it is pulled from the shelves. That's a vitamin K black box warning. Okay, so that being said, here's the vitamin K insert. That's the warning.
That's okay.
Well, that's my son. Sorry.
They do.
I was like, wait, is that my son?
We're a very child-friendly place.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Black box warning, severe reactions, including fatalities, have occurred during and immediately after IV administration, even when precautions have been taken with proper dilution and avoidance of rapid infusion. Severe reactions also reported after IM administration. Typically, these severe reactions involve hypersensitivity or anaphylaxis and include shock and cardiac or respiratory arrest. Okay? Same part of the insert. I'm just showing you a different page under warnings. It says benzyl alcohol as a preservative is bacteriostatic sodium chloride injection has been associated with toxicity in newborns. Toxicity in newborns. Benzyl alcohol has been reported to be associated with fatal gasping syndrome in premature infants. My daughter, for example. Warning, this product contains aluminum that may be toxic. Aluminum may reach toxic levels with prolonged parenteral administration if kidney function is impaired. Premature neonates are particularly at risk because their kidneys are immature. Premature. My doctor never told me that. In fact, my pediatrician, when Riley had a follow-up appointment, had no answer for me. The doctor at the at the NICU in the hospital, one of the best hospitals in the plant in this nation, said, I don't know what's wrong with your daughter. We're just going to give her antibiotics just in case. We don't know what's wrong with your daughter. We don't know why she's not breathing. Precautions. Third page on the insert. pediatric use, hemolysis, jaundice, hyperbilirubinemia, I didn't say that proper, bilirubinemia, in neonates, particularly those that are premature, may be related to the dose of vitamin K1 injection. Therefore, the recommended dose should not be exceeded. Adverse reactions, deaths have occurred after intravenous and intramuscular administration. The possibility of allergic sensitivity, including an anaphylactoid reaction, should be kept in mind. My doctor never told me that. This is my daughter. After her vitamin K shot, nobody knew what was wrong with her. 7 days after she was born.
Can I ask
with
you
respiratory
up,
arrest. And here's the amazing thing. Is you see that line I read to you? Hyperbilirubinemia. She had that. She had that. We had her on lights. I could not even do kangaroo care because it was so bad. They had to have her under lights in an incubator and rotated every hour because she had it. So my daughter was a perfect example of somebody who, hey, if my doctor had known, and by the way, I asked my pediatrician, he never knew. He never knew that, my pediatrician right now, 30 years in the medical field, he never knew that there's a black box warning on the vitamin K shot. Never knew. So if we're going to mandate, which is what it says it's going to require a vitamin K1 injection. I read the bill, and it puts in parentheses and italics, which means they can remove the option of oral. It's going to require or even suggest that this is the only route you have without saying, by the way, your daughter could die or your kid could die, or you could actually have an anaphylactic shock, or you could have a respiratory arrest. None of that is ever mentioned. That should be in there. If you're going to say this is the direction we're going to take it, I'd like to see it say in there, by the way, this is a side effect that you're going to have if you decide to do the K1 injection. I will say, though,
wrap up, please.
Yes, I will say that's the last part of what I'm going to say. But my son, you just saw him, even though he has a healthy set of lungs when he ran out of the room, he had the oral. He has no issue with the oral. He had the best vitamin K levels, and he's doing wonderful. He's way above his level. So I just have to say oral should always remain an option as well as vitamin K. In fact, I think she's going to follow up. The studies that were done that are published online show that there's no difference whatsoever with the injection and the oral. And that's my end. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Me?
Whoever. Pick one.
Okay, I'll go. Hi, thank you for all of my esteemed committee members here. This is my first time testifying in front of anything like this, so I'm a little nervous and appreciate the opportunity. My name is Paula Bryant-Tarise, and this bill came to my attention because my daughter's care provider, her name is Helen, she's pregnant and has been researching this issue for herself, and she can't be here because she's having, well, she's pregnant. She wants to stay home and near the hospital, so she doesn't really want to be traveling, but I did get a statement from her today, and I'll share that with you in a little bit. I was interested in some of the questions you all posed initially. I'm very impressed, I have to say, with the intelligence and consideration of those questions. And the question that struck me was why enshrine into law, if, you know, best medical practice, why do we need to do that? And, of course, then the question came up, what are the penalties? You know, and as parents, this is where the fear strikes the heart, because often the penalty for not complying with the law when it concerns the welfare of your children is to have your children removed by CPS. And I have experienced this, not with myself, but another parent who chose, that I know personally, who chose not to have, she did not have hepatitis B herself, so she knew her newborn was not at risk for having hepatitis B. And yet, so when she questioned it and said, can we put off this decision till tomorrow, I'm exhausted, it's 3 a.m., I've been in labor for God knows how long, they came in the morning with the police and the CPS and took her child, and she had to go to court and get the child back, a newborn.
I think that's a very unusual story.
I would hope it's unusual, but I know what I know a person has happened to. And, of course, the fear that parents have is that if, in fact, we do want to opt for the oral over the injectable, that that could end up being the conclusion. But that just came up. I'm going to go on with what I had to say. I understand from, researching the Oregon Health Authority that when the number of injections goes up, compliance goes down. This pertained to vaccines particularly, but most parents would not really distinguish between an injectable vitamin K and a vaccine. It's still an injection. So, you know, parents these days are concerned about toxins and adverse reactions and, overly invasive medical procedures in general, especially with new moms, are desiring more control over their birth experience. I think this country has the highest first day infant mortality in the industrialized world, is my understanding from what I've done. We don't know what's causing that, but we've never asked that question. Could the injectable vitamin K possibly play a role? We've never done a control group on that. It's possible. So with all that said, I feel that the bill, as it's presented, is likely to backfire and decrease the uptake of vitamin K. And I will read you what Helen wanted me to share with you. Her name is Helen Lutz, and she says, I'm due to have my first baby in April. We're planning on administering vitamin K orally after my daughter's born. We're choosing to refuse the vitamin K shot, even though it's been proven to dramatically reduce the risk of VKDB. I suspect if she had a C-section and it became, evident that that was a wise choice to do, she would change her mind. But at the outset, she's expecting a normal pregnancy and birth. She says, this decision is based on comparing the risk factors, the probability that declining the shot will result in this condition, versus the knowledge that the injection has the black box warning. I'll try to wrap it up because it's kind of long. I'll just say, if oral vitamin K was not an option, we would still decline the vitamin K injection. Taking away the oral option would not result in a lower risk for the baby. It would increase the risk because we would then decline vitamin K altogether.
Thank you. Please.
Hello. My name is Stacey Black. Thank you for having me here today. I am here because when I read the bill, I thought, to me, it looked like they were proposing to take away the oral dose. So that's why I drove all the way from Eugene. So when it's hashed out, just to be, certain that that's not taking away the option for parents, because I, too, unless I knew I was high risk, C-section, or we know, low birth weight, or if there's forceps used, there's certain things that babies will, high risk of bleeding. If I had a baby was high risk of bleeding, I would have thought twice and taken the injection. But because of the risks associated with the injection, and because from the research I've done, the amount of babies who take the oral, they have very low risk of bleeding out. And I encourage you all to read the science and do the comparison, because from my experience, and I'll hopefully find that doctor and talk to him a little bit more about it, too. But if I had a low-risk pregnancy then and a low-risk birth and my baby was fine, I, too, would have just said no injection. And if there's no oral option, I, too, would have just taken my baby home because of the risks associated with the injection. So I fear that this is going to take away our ability to have the oral and have a little bit of the protection from vitamin K. Sorry. From my research, it seems to me that no one's keeping track in the United States of how many infants get vitamin K and how many infants develop bleeds. I don't believe the U.S. is tracking this data, and from the research that I've found in Europe, again, like I said, let me try to find the exact statistics here, but... from the statistic from Europe, when infants do not receive any vitamin K at birth, it shows that 4.4 to 10.5 infants out of 100,000 will develop the late VKDB. And when infants receive oral vitamin K at least three times, then that number drops to 1.4 to 6 infants out of 100,000. And then when they receive the shot at birth, it drops down to 0.62 infants per 100,000. So for me, the number is comparable. And then I also would look at, well, how often do babies have adverse reactions? And I don't think we know that. We heard testimony of somebody, you know, in the room that it happened to. So I think we need to be careful when we're crafting these laws that seriously affect families and newborn babies. So
the data you just presented indicate the risk is twice as much as oral as with IM. And the number is 6 per 100,000.
Yes. That was.
There's no point. I mean,
those are the numbers that I have and that I would use to make a decision as a mom. And what we don't have is the adverse reaction. Like if they take the injectable vitamin K, how often does a baby react negatively? And we don't have that. I haven't found that number.
Can you wrap up, please?
Yes. Okay. So, I guess just. Yeah, okay. And I just, yeah, thank you for your time, and I appreciate you hearing my testimony.
Thank you for coming. Could you call the next panel, please?
Sarah Gobet, Bob Snee, and Amber, and I have no clue, Amber's last name. Hinther Platten?
That's pretty close.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to hold your testimony for 2 minutes, please.
Sorry. Habit, yeah. Okay. So, Chairman
person.
Greenlick, I'm, and representatives of the committee, I'm Sarah Gobet, and I am here today in opposition of HB 2664. If you want to take them, thank you. After complications following the vitamin K shot with my oldest son, I opted out of all forms of vitamin K for my now one-year-old, whom you can hear screaming with healthy lungs. Would you like to know what synthetic vitamin K enthusiasts don't understand? The thought that babies, and all animals for that matter, have lower levels of vitamin K at birth for a beneficial protective reason. I'm just going to throw some of these common sense based thoughts out there and let's consider them. First, in order to absorb vitamin K, we have to have a functioning biliary and pancreas system. Your infant's digestive system isn't fully developed at birth, which is why we give babies breast milk and delay solids until at least 6 months old, and why breast milk only contains a small amount of highly absorbable vitamin K. Too much vitamin K can tax the liver and cause brain damage, among other things. As baby ages and the digestive tract, mucosal lining, gut flora, and enzyme functions develop, baby can process more vitamin K. Low levels of vitamin K at birth just makes sense. Secondly, cord blood contains stem cells, which protect a baby against bleeding and perform all sorts of needed repairs inside an infant's body. Here's the kicker. In order for the baby to get this protective boost of stem cells, cord cutting needs to be delayed and the blood needs to remain thin so stem cells can easily travel and perform their functions. Imagine that. A baby has his own protective mechanism to prevent bleeding and repair organs that wasn't discovered until after we started routinely giving infants vitamin K injections. Third, I'm almost done, a newborn might have low levels of vitamin K because its intestines are not yet colonized with bacteria needed to synthesize it, and the vitamin K cycle isn't fully functional in newborns. It makes sense, then, to bypass the gut and inject vitamin K into the muscle, right? Except a baby's kidneys aren't fully functional either. Fourth, babies are born with low levels of vitamin K compared to adults, but this level is still sufficient to prevent problems. Vitamin K prophylaxis isn't necessarily needed. Finally, several clinical observations support the hypothesis that children have natural protective mechanisms that justify their low vitamin K levels at birth. I don't know about you, but we should probably figure out why that is before we inject now and worry about it later. Do you know why vitamin K? All right, let's skip that real quick. Almost done. Since 1985, the medical profession has known that oral vitamin K raises the blood levels 300 times higher than it would be normally, and the injectable results in vitamin K levels up to 9,000 times thicker than an adult's blood. Baby's blood thickened with vitamin K causes a situation where stem cells have to move through sludge, not nicely greased blood vessels full of blood, which can allow stem cells to access anywhere. Maybe one day it will dawn on the medical profession that not only are cord blood stem cells important and useful to the newborn baby, but that stem cells need to thin blood for a reason. Any fetus that is being wrung out like a wet towel while traveling down a narrow drain pipe, sorry for that analogy, can incur damage in any part of the body, including the brain, and needs a built-in fix-it. And stem cells cross the blood-brain barrier. In fact, stem cells go anywhere. God's design has solutions for situational problems, three solutions, and the second is the fact that naturally in the first few days, a baby's blood clotting factors are lower than normal. But pediatricians consider this a defect, so they want to give vitamin K, which results in blood nearly 100 times thicker than an adult's. I think I wrote that down wrong, but it's too thick. This vitamin K injection, so they say, is because the baby wasn't designed right. And if you don't give a vitamin K injection, the baby could bleed to death.
Can you wrap it up, please?
Yes. Why are blood clotting factors in babies low in the first few days after birth? And why has the baby got much thinner blood as a result? The hypothesis may be that thinner blood allows freer and quicker access of cord blood stem cells to any part of the body. After all, why would stem cells have to fight through a baby's blood, which is now 100 times thicker than any adult's, courtesy of another needle? I implore you to take these facts into consideration before passing this bill, and I appreciate your time. Sorry. Just tried to rush through that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing my testimony today as well, and your patience with all of the moms who came out. Thankfully, my daughter did have school today. She would be here. My name is Amber Sims, and I oppose SB 2644. I do not believe a medical procedure that involves a known risk from the manufacturers that carries a black box warning, the FDA's strictest warning, should be the main option offered. Otherwise, I would have to sign a statement that I would be declining a medical procedure for my daughter. And the oral option is available and is safe and effective and does not pose any risk. My husband and I received the oral vitamin K for our daughter, who's now 3 and a half, in gel form in her mouth in the first 24 hours of life. And it was a pain-free experience and provided the necessary dose to keep her safe. We want to have another child and would also decline a vitamin K injection and opt for an oral option. Both my husband and I carry a genetic mutation, which means that we do not have the same ability to process or metabolize known toxins like polyoxyl 35, which is antifreeze, benzyl alcohol, and aluminum, which are contained in the injections, but not in the oral option, making the injection of vitamin K shot actually a dangerous and ill-advised procedure for our children. And I just wanted to share that with you, and that was information we found out, thankfully, after we had our daughter, but not advance, and I'm very grateful for not running into any complications with her. But thank you for hearing me today, and I oppose this bill.
Thank you for coming.
Mm-hmm.
She's all the witnesses.
Rick Kenema has a question.
Mr. Kenema?
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a comment. You know, for me, today's discussion was a reminder of why we have licensing boards and why we have continuing education and why we have advocacy groups. And I think if we get down in the details, if we're not careful, we put into law things that last at a minimum of 2 years and don't always respond well to the realities that people face, and also individual differences, amazing differences. And we call it not a science, we call it practice. And I think that's what medical practice is.
Remember, the stuff's in law already. All we're doing is modifying it. Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2580 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2660. What do we have in this bill?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2660 is at the request of Representative Bynum. It requires the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Consumer and Business Services to create and implement educational campaign about the options available to breast cancer patients for insurance coverage of breast reconstruction, breast prosthesis, and breast forms. First panel will be Representative Bynum, Alan Gabriel, and Jory Walker.
Go for it.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Janelle Bynum, and I'm the state representative for House District 51, and this is my bill. Before working on House Bill 2660, I was unaware that over 70% of women who are eligible for breast reconstruction post-mastectomy are not aware of their care options. And this is especially true for women of color, women who are of a lower socioeconomic class, as well as older patients. So since this has been federally mandated since 1998, HB 2660 is a simple bill that directs DCBS and OHA to provide links to digital educational materials from nonprofit organizations on their individual websites, which provides just one more avenue for breast cancer patients to receive the information they need in order to fully understand their options that are available to them. And so we recognize that this is a good first step. We're hoping to work with the agency in the future so that the information provided is accessible also to women who speak languages other than English as their primary language or who may not be computer literate. So I'm happy to also introduce Dr. Alan Gabriel, who's a plastic surgeon at Peace Health, and he works in Portland and Vancouver. So I'll turn it over to him.
Great. Thank you, Representative Bynum, and Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Thank you again for having me. I'm very excited to be here for this public hearing in support of our bill, House Bill 2660. To summarize what this bill is all about.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, Alan, I'm sorry. Alan Gabriel. I'm a plastic surgeon at Peace Health.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bottom line, to simplify what this bill is all about, as this discussion is all about, is patient values and women's rights. And when we look at the diagnosis of breast cancer in 2016, approximately 250,000 women were diagnosed with breast cancer, and really 1 in 8 women have a lifetime risk of developing this cancer. That's not including ductal carcinoma in situ, which is DCIS. That would be, if you added that, that would be a lifetime risk of 1 in 6. Unfortunately, African-American women under the age of 40 have the highest incidence based on peer-reviewed literature, and this is the most common cancer among Latino female patients. Breast reconstruction is all about to make the women whole again, and it's an integral part of the cancer treatment and the road to survivorship. This also includes not only surgery, but also the use of external prostheses. Please don't misunderstand this bill in terms of us pushing surgery for patients who are not desiring to have reconstruction. All this is about patient information, patient education, so they can actually make an informed decision. And this includes reconstruction at time of mastectomy or delayed, or if the patient chooses not to have reconstruction, they may have the opportunity to obtain external prostheses that is also covered by the insurance carriers. There was a Women's Healthcare Health and Cancer Rights Act that was passed in 1998 as a federal mandate to cover what I just briefly discussed. Unfortunately, states have had to undertake similar bills to help educate their citizens in terms of what is available and what education in breast cancer restoration is available to them. Because we have seen, based on peer-reviewed literature, that 70% of women are still not informed of all their options. So the education will include the option for surgery or the option not to have surgery and use of external prostheses. We're asking for all of us to start focusing again what patients value and what we want patients to know in terms of their opportunities and options that they have. Because quality life is important in the breast cancer journey because it's an emotional journey that leads to physical change as well as it's mentally challenging at times. You will meet some survivors next. We'll also echo that this disease is a lifetime, has a lifetime impact, not only on the patient themselves, but also on their family members and their friends. So I urge you to support this bill as a first step for educating our community and our women about their rights. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Alonzo Leon.
I don't have a question, but a comment. I just wanted to say that I appreciate that when we think about communication with women, that it's important to include multi-language perspectives and considering computer literacy. So I appreciate that that's something that you are going to think about in the future, because that is very important when we communicate or when we think about communicating and making sure that all women have the information for them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You want to testify too?
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and the committee, for allowing me to testify here today. This is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart. Unfortunately, I fell under that 70%.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jory Walker. I'm a breast cancer survivor, 5 years. So unfortunately, I fell under that 70% of women that were not informed of my options. I feel now, looking back, that was probably largely due to my insurance. But nevertheless, my course of treatment was not the best course of treatment for my diagnosis or the advanced stage of my cancer. Unfortunately, it took me a full year to realize that after I'd been through many painful surgeries, I'd been through chemotherapy and radiation, and it wasn't until the emotional impact of my decision really sunk in that I realized I needed to make a change and that I couldn't live with this decision to keep my breasts. So fortunately, I was able to connect with a group of women that sort of helped me through my emotional journey, as well as professional health providers. And I ultimately decided on bilateral reconstruction. I honestly believe if I had made that decision prior to when I did, I'm not sure my insurance company would have paid the cost for that. I, in the process of going through this journey, was changed insurance companies and was able to, I believe, get treatment that otherwise would not have been available to me. I'm very well educated. I'm an informed patient. But when you're diagnosed with breast cancer, you don't know the right questions to ask. It's you feel like a deer in the headlights. There are terms you never, ever want to hear. You never want to know what they mean. But you're faced with those facts. And who do we look to as for professional advice is our caregivers. And I wanted my doctors to tell me, and I don't think, unfortunately, in my case, that I was clearly informed of all of the consequences and choices that I had as a survivor. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Do you think if this bill had been in place, you would have been better informed?
Absolutely. I was assigned a nurse navigator upon my diagnosis, and she did not even tell me really what my options were. I just simply took the advice of a doctor that my primary care physician suggested I see. I absolutely believe that I would have been better informed. And again, I was well insured. Obviously speak English, and the system failed me. So I worry for all of those women of color, Hispanic women we know that are greatly affected by this disease, that are not getting even the information that they deserve, nor did I get.
Any questions to this panel?
Can you get her?
Please.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I know that the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance supports and has a support letter in here. I'm curious about if you have any reason that you can think of that this information is not getting to 70% of the women. You've been in the field for a long time. And with this bill, how can we ensure that this information does get to women?
Representative Kindergarten, that's an excellent question, and Jory brings up a very good point. And we have to also remember at any given time when we are patients and we're diagnosed with a devastating disease that is life-changing, just like she stated, not all information or not all the questions are asked. There is always a possibility that the physicians are saying the information to our, I know, and nowadays we're giving it more. However, only 20 to 30% of that information is retained. Mm-hmm. At any visit, I will let my patients know that you will probably not remember more than 70% of what I just discussed today, but you need to call me with any questions or concerns because it's important. And this is when information that is easily available, whether if it's in different languages, of course, that's the future plan. It's going to be very important for them to have that in hand. So when they're sitting at home and they're thinking what was discussed during the conversation, what was said, so they know what their options are. Because it's very simple. It's women's rights for when it comes to breast health, and those just are simple that can be handed, and it's just one piece of six bullet points, and that's all they would need to know. So it's a great point. I think there's a lot of information, and sometimes, yes, we fail at giving information. That's why there needs to be some areas where we can fall back to and have patients be able to access that information somehow.
Thank you, Chair. I just commend you for bringing this forward. I think we've come a long way with women's health issues, but clearly we have a long way to go. But until we continue to bring these things forward and we continue to have the conversation and we continue to bring it to the forefront, we're never going to continue to make that headway. So I just appreciate you bringing it forward, and I think we all have a responsibility to have discussions like this and to make this things like this a priority. So I just appreciate your willingness to do that and to continue this work and to be brave to be here today. So thank you.
We have another panel coming up also. Representative Kenmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just comment. My first wife had breast surgery, mastectomy, and then subsequent surgeries and all kinds of complications. But your comment really rang true, and that was I attended most all of her visits, not all of them. She always had to be accompanied because I found from the very first visit, her recollections of those visits and mine were dramatically different. And she was so upset. And she was a very bright master's degree school teacher. I mean, she's a smart lady. It was emotionally overwhelming. And it was really important to have someone with her at every visit, I felt.
I'd like to add to that, when I was diagnosed, I was single head of household with nobody in my life except a 95-year-old father. So I navigated this journey all by myself, and I think that contributed to some issues as well and lack of information for all of those reasons. Thank you.
I think those of us that have had a cancer diagnosis know, even when they're pretty experienced and looking for information, it's pretty hard to focus.
Ms. Kenny Geyer, and can we call the next panel, please?
Thank Thank you. I just want to say, you know, I'm very supportive of this, and I know that you've worked really hard to keep this bill from being too onerous on any kind of party and just get the word out to the extent possible. I do wonder, because of your story where it sounded like insurance was questioning whether they have to cover it, and in fact the 1998 law, the federal law, meant way before ACA, meant that private and public carriers have to cover this. Eventually, I hope that you keep track on where that 70% goes in our own state. I know Washington State has just initially passed, at least in one of their chambers, something similar. But I do think that another direction that we might want to go in the future is to have an insurance carriers, when there's a breast cancer diagnosis, put something in their statements.
We move on.
Yep.
We have another panel and we have another bill.
Just to make a real quick comment about that, I didn't know about the 1998 Women's Health Initiative. I found that out through a support group. So that was, again, a huge piece of missing information that was not given to me as a patient newly diagnosed. So I totally agree. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would you call the next panel, please?
Sandra Day, Sherry Stowes, and Marcia Kelly.
Is that the end of the list?
That is the end of the list.
I'm going to ask you to be brief. We're running toward the end of our time.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm with the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We are in support of this bill in concept. I think that there may be some needs to define what sorts of nonprofits would be attached to the OHA website in the because there are many, many nonprofits working in the area of breast cancer support. And so I would hope that as the bill goes through, it's tweaked a little to give the OHA and DCBS some latitude to make some good practical decisions about how many links and the quality of the links. And in addition, maybe allow governmental entities that have information on breast cancer reconstruction and breast cancer treatment to be included, like the National Institute of Health, because I found that website was very, very helpful. As a former staff member of the American Cancer Society, I know that it is very, very important for people to have support and to have someone with them as they go through the process of cancer diagnosis. And so I would hope that we as a community of women would continue to have support groups to help people as they face these difficult decisions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sandra Day, and I am a twice breast cancer survivor. 20 years ago, at the age of 50, I was diagnosed with a very aggressive cancer, of which I got second opinions for the treatment because I was going to go through radiation, chemo, and then hormone therapy following that, and axillary dissection, which is a very painful thing. And as part of that, I volunteered to participate in a research study at the hospital that would save women in the future from having the full axillary dissection. It would just be the sentinel node. So I know what it is to give back, and I'm here today in support of this bill because I went through 19 years of MRIs, ultrasounds, and of course the usual mammograms, because I have very dense breasts and it's hard to detect cancers. And I was on an emotional roller coaster of, I didn't go in at my annual mammogram and they say, go home, you're fine, we'll see you next year. It was always, you've got to come back for diagnostics, you've got to come back for more things for us to then tell you we've still found nothing. And the next 6 months, the cycle would start again. So for 19 years, it was emotionally draining on me, my family, my friends. I worked for a Fortune 100 company, had very good insurance, but this was 1996 when I had my cancer, and no one ever suggested I have reconstruction. My surgeon told me, oh yes, you could have that breast fixed but it's cosmetic surgery not covered. And at that point, it was like you turned the mental thought off. I don't want any more to do with medical anything. I'll just go do what I've got to do to make sure I don't have cancer. Well, fast forward to 2016. I began having problems in the original breast, of which I had another lumpectomy there. Then it moved with diagnostics on my left breast, with core needle biopsies, my MRIs, and they still weren't sure, so they did surgery. And the pathology report in November came back that there was a cancer hidden behind the primary cancer that they went in after. So then you've got a decision of, do I still want to be amputated piece by piece, or do I want to do this the right way? And in 1998, when the federal laws were passed, I had both male physicians, female physicians, because I worked in several states over time. None of them ever told me about I could have this covered by insurance. And they examined me. They knew the looks, the deformity that I had, and nothing was ever brought up. So I'm here today strongly wanting to help other women not to go through misinformation and emotional pain when it can be avoided. Thank you.
We're glad you're with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Greenlee and committee, very nice to be here. My name is Sherry Stose. I am in the healthcare field. I'm a registered nurse and have been for over 40 years. I knew nothing about the 1998 Health Care Act until, ironically, I was diagnosed 5 years ago with breast cancer. I was of the very fortunate few that my surgeons knew about the Health Care Act and that I actually did have options. With my diagnosis, my surgeon presented me with my options. There was a lot of discussion, thought, and I chose to have breast cancer, double mastectomy reconstruction done. I found that for me, I was in the fortunate end, and unfortunately I was only in that 30%, but I can't begin to tell you, breast cancer is physically extremely traumatic, but the emotional side is far more traumatic than the physical side. However, by having breast cancer reconstruction done, I felt that it gave me a little bit of an edge. I feel whole and normal again. I'm not going through that anxiety of testing, imaging every 3 to 6 months, which is indeed very anxiety provoking. So I have been able in those 5 years, I've moved on. I'm emotionally healthy, I'm physically healthy, and I would love that all women would know what their options are when it comes to breast cancer and reconstruction. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2660 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2675. Invite Representative Hayden to introduce this. But what are we having this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2675 requires community health improvement plans be adopted by the CCO organizations and the community advisory councils to focus on and develop a strategy for integrating physical, behavioral, and oral health care services.
Deborah Law, you want to join us in this? Representative Hayden, have at it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair.
Dude,
how was that? No,
that's my bit.
Thank you for being on.
Nasi.
I'm
nervous.
Thank you for the opportunity to come testify before you today. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7. I'm going to be pretty brief on this in the time constraint that we have. We have set up, the Oregon Health Plan has set up something called coordinated care organizations, and within that we have required that there's a community advisory council, or a CAC, that we refer to with certain goals. One of the goals that...
Can I interrupt a minute? Would you hang in after this? We have to have a very brief work session to introduce some committee bills. I'm sorry, I didn't want to lose my quorum while you were talking.
Okay. Continuing on. when the CCOs were originally set up, it was kind of a partial physical health, later the oral health, and not complete yet the mental behavioral health aspect of that. And that was the original design. I think that has worked to the capacity that it could have at the time, and now we're wanting to take a step forward and make sure that these CCOs are fully engaged with the concept of integration of oral health, physical health, behavioral, and mental health. This is a very simple bill that puts that in line 24 on the bill and spells out that this is the objective that we want them to continue to move forward with. And that's my presentation.
Thank you. Do a pretty good job. It's my bill, too.
You want to join me?
No, who else has bill assist?
He leave you out.
No. Please.
Chair Greenlick, co-chairs, and members of the committee, thank you for letting me be here. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy, and I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care, a dental care organization serving Oregon Health Plan members and contracted with 14 of the 16 coordinated care organizations. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2675 in favor of it. As Representative Hayden has already spoke to, the legislation that created the coordinated care organizations also indicated that they needed to have a community advisory council who was to provide input for shaping what's called the community health improvement plan. In that plan, it does not specifically require that oral health be included in the strategies of integration or coordinated care. This bill basically adds that requirement along with the other health services of physical health and behavioral health, which is in essence the intent of what the transformed delivery system was about. So it fits the nature of what the CHIPs are trying to accomplish, and it calls out specifically the need to have oral health as part of those strategies.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will you rejoin us, please?
Sure.
We don't have prepared to work this bill, but we were talking about we'll try and schedule it for Friday or next Monday. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2675 and open up a work session for the purpose of introducing a couple of committee bills.
Mm-hmm. You ready?
Ready.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 3609, dated February 3rd, 2017, LC 3644, dated February 3rd, 2017, and LC 4133, dated February 17th, 2017.
Representative Noyce's move enters as committee bills: LC 3609, LC 3644, and LC 4133. To remind you all, by introducing these as committee bills does not mean we're taking any position on them, nor we'll even get them before us as opposed to another committee. Is there any objection to introducing them as committee bills?
Yeah.
And if you or notes, please call the roll.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Bueller.
No.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nos.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenlick.
Aye. Motion carries. Will be introduced as committee bills. We are adjourned 2.5 minutes early.
Oh,
2.5 minutes early.
Oh,
we are adjourned.